human beings will always make calculations and use whatever is available, including the courts, including violence, including anything, including witchcraft, I have heard. So what one can do something about is to say, given that people will now start trying to use the courts for political reasons, what mechanisms can we have in place to either stop it completely or at least to minimize its negative effects?
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
In a landmark ruling in February of this year, Malawi's High Court concluded that the country's president, Mr. Peter Mutharika, was not duly elected. The court thus annulled the May 2019 elections in Malawi, citing massive irregularities. The court ordered new elections within 5 months and concluded that the Malawi Electoral Commission had failed to carry out its responsibilities according to the constitution and electoral law. The judges also highlighted fundamental challenges that have long plagued Malawi's first-past-the-post electoral system. The judges ruled that the long-standing practice in Malawi of applying a simple plurality standard to determine the winner of presidential elections was actually contrary to the majority principle enshrined in the country's constitution. And in what some consider to be a welcome surprise, the judges argued in favor of amending the law so that a winning candidate should achieve an absolute majority of 50% plus one vote. The lengthy, meticulously detailed, and unanimous ruling by the five judges of the High Court has attracted widespread acclaim within Malawi, but also abroad. With the exception of one case in Kenya, it is not normal for courts in Africa to annul election results, even when there is evidence of massive irregularities. And once results are announced, it is often taken for granted that no court would overturn such results. Now, this particular court ruling in Malawi followed numerous protests organized throughout the country after the May 2019 elections. And these protests played a very important part in the overall scheme of things. Indeed, mass demonstrations held over 9 months signaled to the judiciary and the international community that Malawi had changed. The clear message was that Malawians were no longer willing to simply accept a fate handed out to them. And there was considerable criticism of the role of international election observers that had, in many ways, approved the results of the 2019 elections. To discuss the implications of this historic case in Malawi is my guest today, Dr. Edge Kanyongolo, perhaps Malawi's most well-known law professor. Over the years, I've had numerous interactions with Edge at the University of Malawi's Chancellor College, and I've learned much from him about the links between law and development. I began by asking Edge to help us better understand the essential features of this landmark ruling.
It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to chat with you again, Dan, and your listeners. Going straight to the case, just a bit of background. Malawi has had regular elections every 5 years since 1994. And at the conclusion of each of those elections, there has been some kind of court challenging one aspect or the other of the results. But most of those court actions protesting the results never really went far, either because they were dismissed at early stages for technical reasons, or the petitioners, the people who had brought the matter to court, essentially ran out of energy. I suppose mostly feeling that events have moved on. But anyway, so comes the election of 2019 as scheduled. It was a tripartite election, which means there was the presidential election, the parliamentary election, and the local government election held simultaneously. Well, at the end of it, the Malawi Electoral Commission, which is the elections management body, declared that Peter Mutharika, leader of the Democratic Progressive Party, who was the incumbent then, had won the elections. In second place was Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party, and in third place was Saulos Chilima of the UTM. The Chilima and Chakwera, those who had come in positions 2 and 3, were unhappy with the results and therefore lodged a petition in the High Court challenging the results. Essentially, the challenge was based on the argument that the election process had been marred with such a degree of irregularities that it raised questions. In fact, it essentially raised the question whether the results that had been declared by the Malawi Electoral Commission were reflected what the will of the people really was. 5 judges, and the reason why we had 5 judges I'll get into perhaps in a minute, but a panel of 5 judges heard the arguments in an unprecedented trial that was broadcast live on radio for the whole several months that the trial took place. It was broadcast live on radio, so it wasn't just a legal process. In many ways, you could say it was a social event as well, which brought together politics, law, and society, if you will, in one place. Because every afternoon, every morning, lots of people would be gathered around their radios listening, but also discussing what was going on. Many days later, I forget exactly how many months, it was quite several months that it took, judgment was given. The judges concluded that, in their view, there had indeed been so many irregularities that the result could not be allowed to stand. And therefore, using the power that they have under the law, which allows judges to nullify elections, they declared that the result could not stand and that there should be a fresh election held within 150 days of that judgment. Subsequently, there was an appeal, but the appeal essentially confirmed this verdict. So effectively, the case ended with a nullification of the results of the presidential election. As I said earlier, it was a tripartite, so let's leave out the other two because there weren't any significant challenges there. But the court said this result can't stand, there were too many irregularities, another election must happen. Let me just point out the significance and then I'll turn it back to you, Dan. What was quite significant, particularly for those of us interested in electoral law, was one, that this was unprecedented. Not only in Malawi, but I have studied quite a number of election cases on the continent. Effectively, you could only find maybe one other example, maybe Kenya. But other than that, it was the conventional wisdom, even among scholars, that there were good reasons why a court was unlikely to nullify an election result in our context. So this essentially challenged conventional wisdom. It was unprecedented. But the other aspect of it was, when you read the case carefully, it said, and it wasn't the judges saying it, it's what the law said, an irregularity essentially means a departure from the law that governs the elections. And the law can be quite technical. You must put those documents in that place. That document must go with that. In other words, it's quite a taxing standard to say that elections must always dot all the I's and cross all the T's, otherwise there are irregularities. So there was a bit of concern when the judgment was delivered that what it might mean was that there would be chaos, that almost every election challenged and would end up in this. But I think that misrepresents the point, because the courts said clearly that, yes, they had nullified the election on the basis of irregularities, but they were not saying that you must have a perfect election. They acknowledged that in the tide of human events, including elections, errors are unavoidable. So it's not as if they set the bar too high. They set it high, but it's not too high. So there are various implications that arise from it. But in short, I think that's basically what I can say is the background, this case that has now become so famous, as it were, across the world. It sets certain standards for elections.
You know, I listened to that live broadcast the final day. I started listening, then I went to class, I taught, I came back. It went on for hours. It was fantastic on social media to witness the energy, the kind of activism, the excitement, the youth being re-energized. So before we get to the Malawi case and talk about more specifics, I want to ask your view on what you think about the kind of media reports, the analyses that have come. You know, I've written something with Happy Kayuni on this, and others have also been writing in popular media. The Financial Times called the Malawi court decision a victory for African democracy. Do you see that the narrative of your country, which often, unfortunately, has been associated with underdevelopment and poverty, the negative sides, suddenly shifting to a much more look to Malawi strategy? How is it for you to observe these reports, these analyses, these trends?
An interesting point, Dan. Yes, there is a sense that we have gone into uncharted territory. We now are on the pedestal of governance and judicial independence, and that we are setting the standard and setting the pace. And I think that there is some truth to that narrative. And it is a welcome narrative, given the fact that, as you say, the narrative about my country has been dominated by how bad things are and whether we can just manage, where survival was considered to be an achievement. So there is a good feeling about this narrative. Even I've been teaching constitutional law for a long time. You get to a point where even you become cynical about whether the values and principles that you are teaching your students mean anything at all. Whether if students are constantly experiencing a gap between what you say and what happens, it does become dispiriting somewhat. So it's a good thing. However, there is some caution that I would like to throw in, because I think that when things have been so bad, it is quite easy to take a small victory and blow it completely out of proportion. And so what I'm saying is this: while the positives indicated by this court victory calls for saying, well, I think we are on a new path now, I would say that we must do this with extreme caution, because a lot of the reasons for the negative narrative that we were talking about earlier remain in place. So structural realities such as, and here, by the way, I'm not just talking about structural inequalities within society, the gap between the rich and the poor, that is bad enough. But I'm talking about structural faults within, for example, the architecture of the law itself. So while we can celebrate judges and courts and lawyers and so on as having scored a victory on behalf of the people and the beginning of a new narrative, the inbuilt inequalities that are there in law and legal institutions still remain. So if today, I don't have the data now, but if today we check whether the poor are disproportionately represented in the prison population, the answer will be yes. Whether the majority of people in Malawi still remain unable to access the courts, either because of the course of justice or indeed the physical accessibility, the courts simply not being there. So I guess what I'm saying is that yes, it's a positive narrative, but I think we must emphasize the point that this is just the beginning of the work that has to be done. If these kinds of victories are going to benefit not only politicians who have lost elections or some part of the elite that has a right to vindicate in the courts, but whether it's the beginning of greater justice. Because ultimately, it's not legality, in my view. Again, there's a personal view. Legality means nothing to me unless it delivers justice. So for me, that's the bigger question.
I'm glad you say that, because I wrote a piece with Happy Kayuni in The Conversation, and I wasn't responsible for the title, the editor was. And the title became "A Great Judgment, But Court Victories Won't Deliver Democracy in Malawi." Obviously, there were some reactions to that, because somebody on social media said, oh, I get so deflated when there's always a but. Let us just celebrate. Let us be optimistic. And I understood that criticism because, you know, every time, and as you rightly say, because there are so few good narratives coming out, that when one does hear something good, one should not come up with the but issue, right? So one shouldn't always qualify.
No. I was saying I agree with you. Although quite frankly, I have now, I don't know, I don't know whether maybe it's because I've been teaching for 30 years, I'm 57 years old, and kind of looking at the afternoon of my life, I don't mind a but at the end of the sentence if it is the truth. Because the problem that I am trying to allude to here is that in the new dawn of a new narrative, unless you add the but early enough, then the danger is that in an effort to sustain the positive narrative, then you go to the other extreme where you begin to downplay and even obscure the but something something. So I think that there is nothing wrong with celebrating. Let me put it this way. I think we are adult enough as citizens to realize that there is no black and white in these victories. I mean, there is a big victory. Let's celebrate it. But let's, at the same time, just bear that in mind. I mean, you can have a party at your house without necessarily trying to lie that you are sick. You can tell people, I'm not feeling too well, but let's have a party anyway.
I think you make a very important point. And I wish to talk to you more about the wider implications. If we could kindly return just to the case for a minute. Well, firstly, everybody was surprised, including me. I was expecting the status quo. And we were very surprised. I think the court ruling mentioned repeatedly the Kenya case. And now it has become, you know, much celebrated. And there's the positive narrative, of course, is that we look to not just Africa, look to Malawi specifically. They're doing certain things that is unthinkable even in Asia and Latin America and the United States. But the two things that I wanted to talk to you about, the first relates to the quality of elections. Do you think the ruling, and perhaps you alluded to this earlier, has the ruling set a high bar in terms of what is understood to be a good, a free, fair election process? There's been a lot of criticism of international observers. There's been, in fact, a lot of support for domestic observers, the feeling in Malawi that one doesn't need foreigners. We could do these things ourselves. So that's one issue I'd like you to please reflect on, the quality of elections. And secondly, this fascinating discussion that one has had in Malawi and the Malawian constitution on this one word, majority, how the constitution has understood it, how majority is understood in the constitution, how the Supreme Court has previously interpreted the term, and how this constitutional court simply went against the conventional wisdom. So if you could please reflect on each of these two issues.
Let me start with the quality of elections. I think, yes, this bodes well for improved quality of elections. And we saw that in the fresh election that had been ordered. I think in the manner of its conduct, you could tell that there was acute awareness on the part, particularly of the Malawi Electoral Commission, that any sidestepping of the law, any cutting of corners, no matter how insignificant it might appear at the time, would actually have far-reaching consequences. So the conscious adherence to the letter of the law was quite evident. And I think with that in mind, generally it improved the quality of elections, but I think part of the quality of elections must go to predictability. Every actor must be able to predict what will happen, what they are allowed to do, what they are not allowed to do, and how to proceed. So I think the certainty of the law came very much to the fore and generally, I think, contributed contributes and will contribute to the better quality elections in future. But I need to add something that's perhaps not even perhaps very obvious when you talk about the quality, because we tend to focus on, to borrow language from elsewhere, on the supply side. The deliverers of the good elections are a good election, the election management body, the Malawi Electoral Commission. But I would say that the quality of elections will also improve on the, let's call it the demand side, on the part of the political parties and their candidates. And one specific way in which the judgment has improved their contribution, the quality of their contribution, is in the quality of monitoring. Because the courts, it was quite clear, you listened to part of the case, the evidence that was presented in court was only as good as the people who presented it. And in a sense, there were two or three monitors who have now become superstars, in a sense. I mean, those who gave evidence about their monitoring work over the results management system, and a few others who actually monitored things on the ground. In short, what I'm saying is I think that the judgment will lead to improvement, not only in the conduct of the election commission, but also the players, the parties, because they will realize from now on that, look, if we don't improve our monitoring, at the end of the day, when this thing goes to court, this is the kind of evidence the courts will expect. So everybody knows now what kind of evidence the courts will expect, and therefore they are going to be more meticulous in collecting information as you go along. Party monitor reports, maybe even NGOs will be a little more meticulous in what they are doing, because ultimately everybody knows that there is the thing. In the eventuality of all this going to court, there will be need for presentation of evidence which is good, solid, etc. So I definitely have no doubt that this points to an improvement in the quality of elections. Of course, there are other factors that would negate all that have nothing to do with the judgment. So violence, the conduct of others, but definitely with regard to the elections, I think it definitely made a contribution. On the majority, a quick summary of it would be this. Our constitution says basically you are elected president if you amass or you win a majority. It uses the word majority. In 1999, following the 1999 elections, which were won by the UDF candidate Bakiri Muluzi, the opposition went to court. Again, another challenge which didn't go too far, but it was fairly substantial. One of the arguments then was that Muluzi had won less than 50% of the vote, and therefore fell short of the constitutional requirement that somebody must have a majority. The thing went to court, and in the event, the court decided that the word majority simply means, in the context of the constitution, meant that the one with more than the rest, or with who has the highest number. So if there are five candidates, each one gets, 20%, well, one gets 19, everybody 20, one gets 21, the one with 21% is the one who wins. So whoever is in the front, a kind of first past the post interpretation of the word majority, if you will. And that was the interpretation that was the law from 1999 on. When the High Court, which is obviously below the court, because in 1999 it was the Supreme Court which had made that decision. At the 2020 elections, the matter went to the High Court, and when they were considering the matter in the High Court, they came to that question because one of the parties had raised it. They were also arguing that Peter Mutharika did not win a majority because he had less than 50%. So the court looked at it and they proceeded as follows. And I was as surprised as many people too on this specific one, because I thought that the whole thing would hinge upon whether there had been irregularities or not, and that this would probably be dismissed offhand. But as we were there sitting, I still remember sitting there watching and actually turning to a colleague and saying, where did this come from? Not because it was what the judges had done was wrong, but because they had just been bold. Now, here is how they had proceeded. On the face of it, they had no latitude to depart because the interpretation of whoever gets most was done by a superior court, which is the Supreme Court. But they, in a sense, boldly and creatively reached to another principle that goes hand in hand with the principle that you are bound by a higher court. And it was this, that you can only be bound by a higher court if in its decision, that higher court based its decision on clear legal authority. So in a sense, there is a kind of an unspoken caveat. When you say the High Court is bound by the Supreme Court, there is a kind of silent caveat that continues to say, if the Supreme Court based its decision on solid legal grounds. And how do we know that? Well, you check the decision of the Supreme Court and see what law they cited. And if they didn't, then lawyers tend to, you know, lawyers are always keen on using fancy Latin words to make it sound sophisticated. So the idea is a concept called per incuriam or per incuriam, which is that, yes, the Supreme Court made a decision, but it made it per incuriam, meaning it made it without being aware that there were certain laws that contradicted its conclusion. So you are, I mean, in plain English, you are simply saying the courts were, they didn't read enough. The High Court didn't read enough. And it's permissible. So this is what the High Court did in this case. They said, well, we have seen the interpretation of majority, which says whoever has the most votes. But when we look at it, I think that decision was made per incuriam. In other words, the court hadn't considered all the available arguments that were available, and therefore we are not bound by it. Now, having declared that they are not bound by it, then in a sense, their hands are free for them now to do their own, as it were, original research on the matter. So this is the manner in which they came to the conclusion that their own reading based on legal authorities, because they went out of their way to try to cover their backs as well, lest somebody tomorrow says they were a per incuriam. So they concluded that majority must surely mean the one with more than half. And the Supreme Court agreed with them. So this is where we are now. This is what it means. But it is simply because the Constitution uses the word majority. By the way, when the first judgment was made, some of us assumed that what the DPP would do when they knew that there was a fresh election coming would be to rush and amend that section, remove the word majority, and simply say the winner is the one with the most votes, because they could have done that. If they had changed the law and got enough parliamentary support for that constitutional amendment, things could have turned out quite differently. So I don't know why, maybe there are good reasons, but why DPP Mutharika didn't take advantage of that hiatus after 3 February when the High Court had delivered its judgment to go back to the law and change it to make sure that it aligned with their existing political support. Just like Muluzi did in 2000 to try to change the constitution to suit his political interests. I think that's one thing we have to research later. Why they didn't take advantage of such an obvious opportunity.
That's a fascinating overview, Edge. Just to put things into context, this idea of trying to change the rules of the game, it was not sudden. It wasn't as if Malawians realized something was problematic after the court ruling. You've actually had for several years now a process whereby, you know, there were attempts to reform the electoral system, to introduce a bill. But I wanted to ask you about what you think happened, because the bill never really made it. It almost appeared to me, and I may be wrong, that the opposition then wasn't very keen either. It just seemed that everybody was worried that lest they not end up with a majority, they risk, you know, not winning the election. So is that a right understanding, that there wasn't a political consensus?
Absolutely perfect. You have it. You have nailed it. That was it. So everybody's gambling and thinking, well, if you know, when if you say the one with the most votes, I mean, that gives me a good chance on my own. But if you say 50 plus one, which was the major issue here, in the electoral reforms for political parties, well, it makes it harder to win an election. So I suspect it was that calculation of vested self-interest that made this situation possible, because they could have amended the law much, much earlier. But I think each was taking a chance. And I think the elections, therefore, kind of was exposed the weakness of this and opened up, I think, opened the eyes of the opposition to an alternative strategic approach to this, which is to say 50+1 can be advantageous, but on condition that we form coalitions and alliances. So there was a bit of a different approach to it. They I can win on my own, which impeded reform. I think then later on was revisited, having gone through the experience and having it waved in their eyes, as it were. So after the judgment, it was quite clear that it was not just the law that was going to change, but the political landscape, that parties were going to start now thinking in terms of what do we do in order to get more than 50%. But you are right on the point that you made, that absolutely, the reason why electoral reforms hadn't really been implemented was because, not just because the incumbent was uninterested in a lot of it, but also almost everybody else thought they had a better chance under the first interpretation.
We see now, of course, uncharted territory in that Malawi has a coalition government, and how this will work out, of course, is going to be interesting, because I often joke with my students in Malawi that I think being the vice president is perhaps the most difficult job in Malawi, given, you know, the prior history. But so far, from news reports, it seems that it's working out well. So how coalition politics will unfold in the near future is going to be pretty interesting to look at. I wanted to also ask you about what you think the ruling has done to increase, at least among the general population, a perception of greater legitimacy of the courts. And this goes back to what you were saying earlier, that while we celebrate this landmark case, we have to also be aware of certain other challenges that exist. And if we could start by getting your perspective on what you think, how do you think an average Malawian citizen views the judiciary? Is there great trust? Do they place great trust? Or do they feel that, or maybe not or, and perhaps they feel that you need to be powerful, rich, to make a case, to be represented? What is the general perception of the courts in Malawi?
I think it is a fairly complex one, in the sense that, on the one hand, you have the general, and when I say general, I just mean based on anecdotal evidence, you have general trust in the courts, in almost abstract terms, represented by the High Court, which nullified the election. So there is a kind of view of the courts as being this high body, almost, I don't want to exaggerate, but something that's a higher authority that derives power from, that is beyond the politician's power. And I think a lot of people, therefore, have ascribed greater legitimacy to the courts, greater trust in the courts, a belief that the courts are impartial, because they can't believe that a court would actually rule against a president and effectively remove a president from position. So there is that one view, and it's a view shared widely, that I think the courts, in fact, what you hear on the street sometimes is the courts rescued us. So there is that sense of this being the knight in shining armor who comes at times of need. But that's one. And when I said it's a complex view, it's because people then, if you probe a little further about the courts, you then get another view. And this, I think, mostly refers to those who have had experience with the courts themselves. So there is you could call it the general detached view of the public, almost in an abstract sense, and those who have actually had to deal with the courts on a day-to-day basis. And in this latter case, you still find significant concerns about corruption in the judiciary. you find incompetence, complaints about incompetence, at least in some respects. And one of the major complaints is inefficiency of the judiciary. Courts, cases that take forever to resolve. And these, therefore, elicit or generate these questions. Why are things inefficient? Why? And you then, therefore, begin to see an interrelation. The courts are corrupt. The courts are biased. And that's, it takes us almost perfectly way back to what we started on earlier, to say the structural concerns about the judiciary remain. The structural concerns about the legal process remain. And the perception that generally the courts will favor the rich rather than the poor. I think there was a survey done last year. I don't think they widely publicized this. I wish they did. But the European Union, I think, gave some funding to the justice sector institutions in Malawi to conduct, use the National Statistical Office to conduct a governance survey, a survey on governance and accountability. And part of that, so it has a lot of interesting raw statistics, if you will. But one of the interesting things in it I was interested in was, do people perceive the courts to be fair? And a lot of them asked, particularly when those were they were asked, I think if I recall, I remember it's been a while since I read it, but it seems the majority said, yes, they are fair, but then the but is actually where the big issue is, because they say courts in Malawi are always favoring the rich. And I think that perception is has been there for a long time, and it's very difficult to eradicate. And it's quite difficult to eradicate because I think it brings together two issues. There is corruption. I mean, there's no doubt. And without wanting to kind of just speculate entirely, I think one could broadly say perhaps that the lower one goes down the hierarchy, the more incidences of corruption one could get. I think let's call it a hypothesis, I think, which we can test later. But there is that feeling that corruption is institutionalized, at least within at certain levels of the judiciary. So there is that, where files go missing, cases go. I mean, I was just reading this morning of a case. This I can't even believe, that a prosecutor was so corrupt, I think he colluded, I don't know, with the magistrate, but they just made the case fail. How did they make it fail? I haven't heard this one before. The prosecutor brought the wrong witness to court to make sure that the state could not succeed. So it was not possible for the state to even present evidence because this guy had nothing, the so-called witness had nothing to do with the case. I think he had been picked from the street, given a few questions to testify. So that's a kind of thing which you can then say it's a worst example of corruption, etc.
I'm glad you mentioned the survey. I actually have read it, and I saw that in terms of perception of impartiality and trustworthiness, a large majority of the respondents in Malawi actually considered the courts to be trustworthy. And they also said that the president must always obey the court rulings, even when the president believes that the rulings are incorrect. But what they were split on, the Malawian respondents, was whether the losing side in an election should always enjoy the right to challenge its defeat in court. And I wonder whether, and I know that there were some concerns when the new election was held, that even this would be challenged. I don't believe that has happened, right? But there is always that fear that every election will drag on. And what I'm actually trying to get at is two things. One is your pet theme that you and I have discussed over the years. You've also written in a book that I edited, this kind of relying on the courts to solve everything rather than finding political avenues. But in terms of Malawi, the last few months, I must say, Edge, I was worried when the ruling first came out and all the incompetence, if I can call it that, of the MEC was highlighted in the ruling. I felt that it was impossible for this institution to suddenly change and undertake such a, you know, a different kind of an, or to carry out such a different type of election. And I must say, I perhaps was totally wrong in my fear. Somehow, all of these inconsistencies, irregularities disappeared. You have an election. The result hasn't been challenged. You know, so I felt that maybe I was being too cynical. But if I can just return to this theme of yours about the judicialization of politics, do you feel that when such famous rulings are made, not just in Malawi, but everywhere else, that everybody's just going to run to the courts to get the courts to meddle in? And I know that in many parts of the world, for example, in India, several of the problems that you've cited apply. There's a case overload. They often say in India, if you have a weak case, you should sue. If you have a strong case, you should settle. So the courts can actually be also used for very different purposes, right?
Absolutely. You do have to be careful because the courts take away the kind of nice, warm questions about justice, delivering fairness, etc. They are a tool. I mean, that can be used just like any, you can use any institution for your own purposes if you have the access, you have the control, and they are amenable to it. And so, for example, courts can be used for political leverage where you are trying to say, well, I'll sue you. You challenge a court. I think this is what happened in 2014. Again, I'm speculating. But where the losing side takes a serious legal challenge, not because they're interested in the legal result, but they want to pressurize the winning candidate to accommodate them in government as a matter of settlement out of court. So it's a kind of route for making deals. So I will challenge your results. I'll make your life uncomfortable as president. But if you offer me a ministerial position, I'll drop my case. So it's quite possible that you can actually have, I think that remains a real danger, if you will. And you know, we've discussed this for years. And I think therefore, the way to approach it, in my view, would be not to say that it won't happen, because I mean, human beings will always make calculations and use whatever is available, including the courts, including violence, including anything, including witchcraft, I have heard. So there isn't much that one can do about that. What one can do something about is to say, use that as a starting point and say, given that people will now start trying to use the courts for political reasons, what mechanisms can we have in place to either stop it completely or at least to minimize its negative effects? You see, a few years ago, I would have said, let's have things in place which make sure that nobody uses the courts for political means. But I think I've become more realistic now to know that sometimes you can't stop an avalanche by simply the power of your will. And therefore, what you need to do is, you know, the avalanche will come down the hill. You know that there is a city, it could cause damage at the bottom. You can't stop the avalanche. So what you might wish to do is devise mechanisms where you can divert, etc. So the management approach is what I mean. So here is what I'm suggesting. You can say, for example, all right, you can challenge election cases. But if in the course of it, for example, if you discontinue beyond a certain point or before you reach a certain stage, because that's what those who are using it for strategic means do, they will press maybe for a couple of months. They will be in the courts while they are pressurizing the incumbent. But if the incumbent is strong-willed and just continues, they usually drop the case. If not, they will succumb, give them a ministerial position. So what you could say is, well, we will assume that if you have started a case, an elections case, that you will definitely go beyond. You will not stop at a preliminary early stage. You can also introduce aspects relating to the costs of a case. You can say, look, elections cases are cases that are perhaps you can develop some kind of reason and say, well, if ultimately it is proven that you actually had no grounds on which to really bring this case, you will pay punitive damages to the courts. In other words, a management system which combines incentives and disincentives to manage the inevitable avalanche. But I don't think that you can put something in place that stops it completely.
A Edge, how would you say the situation in Malawi is now? Is there a sense of optimism, hope? That is the kind of feeling I got when I last was in Malawi in February and March before the whole lockdown started everywhere else. I felt that the youth felt energized because, as you know, for many years, Malawians have supported democracy strongly. They've not always been satisfied with democracy, what they're getting out of democracy, but they've been strong supporters. And I know that your daughter is extremely active in terms of generating youth awareness, but they've often felt, the youth in Malawi, pretty, you know, neglected. The leaders tend to be very old, unfortunately. The youth are not necessarily, you know, seen to be important enough. And this ruling, I suppose, was one of those, if you could call it a catalyst to instilling a sense of optimism and hope. But is that your take? Or do you think this was a one-off thing and that many other institutional reforms have to take place before you can say that Malawi is on a process of consolidating, becoming much more of a mature democracy? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. But I think there is a sense of optimism. There is a sense that we have crossed a bridge, a very significant bridge, and that because we have managed to cross that bridge, that the journey is possible. As you say, I think the youth and their position in the democratization process, I think, quite came to the fore here. Because we have mentioned the case, but let's not forget that parallel to that were these series of street demonstrations. Parallel to that was this unprecedented use of social media, for example, to influence, to lobby, to make the case for change, to bring accountability. A lot of the cases that are being mentioned now, I mean, that are being investigated now relating to corruption, etc., these were cases that have been debated among relatively young people online for a long time. So I guess to sum up, I would say it is a moment of optimism. It is a moment at which, when I talk to some of my younger friends, I find that there is a sense that we have crossed a bridge. But I think a lot of them have been disappointed before. And therefore, they are still holding on to their bets in a sense and saying, let's see what happens. Now, because of that, it makes it incumbent upon the current political elite, in particular those who are in government, to ensure that they sustain that initial optimism by at least avoiding mistakes of the past. Because these youth will be acutely aware of the signals that may, the negative signals that may be there. So, like you said, If they see, for example, that very few youths are being incorporated now in the new government in terms of cabinet and boards of statutory corporation, well, those are the things that are the signals and indicators. I think they will start wondering again whether what they had crossed was simply one bridge or whether it was their bridge. Because don't forget, Dan, I mean, 1994, the optimism in 1994, one hasn't ever seen even before that. I mean, people thought we were on the verge of major change. Within 6 years, the president was trying to change the constitution, change it in his own way, etc. Muluzi goes, Bingu Mutharika comes, and you remember, particularly in his, I think it was second election, he wins an overwhelming majority, and people are thinking, oh, here is a serious technocrat. We will forget all that nonsense, and we are going to focus on governance. And everybody celebrates, and we're saying, here we are. Unfortunately, that large mandate which he gets, he then turns around and feels that and goes against or goes after some youth interests, including violation of academic freedom, etc. So I guess it is a moment of hope. Many of my young friends say they are very hopeful. And many of them, because they were not there in 94, so this is their 1994, in a sense.
I'm glad you mentioned the role of protests, because, yes, you know, there is a tendency sometimes to get a bit carried away by just focusing on one aspect, which is the legal the judgment and sort of celebrating it and perhaps underplaying. There's always the risk of not appreciating the 9 months or more of protest, daily protest, mobilization, awareness generation, the role of civil society, the role of youth that enabled the courts to make that decision and maybe even empowered the five judges to act more boldly than they originally thought they would.
I couldn't have put it better. I couldn't have put it better than. I think that focusing on the courts would be a bit misleading and inaccurate. But I was making the further point that there is a reason why we want to focus on the courts, or we like focusing on the courts, because it has the neat structure of a theatrical performance. It has the structure which intellectual types like yourself and myself, we like. A beginning, a neat beginning, a neat end. It's like a perfect plot for a movie. They are the bad guys, they are the good guys, and there is a good conclusion where the good guys win. So I think it's almost too attractive. But the reality is more complex, as you say. And I would agree with you entirely that the various forces and their contribution to creating the right environment for the courts to make their decision. But not only that, but for the court's decision to be, let's call it, reluctantly accepted by the incumbent. I think part of the acceptance of the court's ruling might have been that, look, if we blatantly disobey the courts, what will those demonstrators do? So it might very well be that it created the space for the judges, but also it signaled to the incumbent that if they actually ignore the court ruling, that then the battle would be taken out of the court. So the role of civil society, the role of the youth, the role of the media, social media, the various activists, the whistleblowers, I think it is the totality of this. But of course, the court makes a difference, because they are the ones with the legal power to actually make a difference and make decisions that changed things.
Edgecon Yangolo, it's always such a pleasure to interact with you. You are my guide, my mentor in Malawi, and I've learned so much from you over the years. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to interact with you, Dan. They're looking forward to next time.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.